The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of Capital Thinking. We're just 12 days away from the elections here in the United States, which means Washington is largely a ghost town with everybody out campaigning. And so this show's episode is going to focus a lot on what's going on abroad in a variety of contexts. We're going to start with peace in the Middle East. We're going to be discussing that issue with some people from the Alliance for Middle East Peace, talk about their ongoing efforts to promote coexistence and cooperative activities in the Middle East region. We're going to be joined by two folks. We were going to be joined by my colleague Matt Culkin, but he's been called away on some last-minute business. We have with us Joel Brownold, who's the United States Director for the Alliance for Middle East Peace, and Huda Abu Arkoub, who's the Regional Director for the Alliance for Middle East Peace. So, Joel, welcome to your maiden voyage here on the show. Let's start by having you give a little bit of an overview about what the Alliance for Middle East Peace is all about, your mission, how you came into existence, and maybe a little bit about who your members are.
Sure, and thank you, Kevin, and it's wonderful to be on the show. So the Alliance for Middle East Peace was founded by a former patent box attorney, Avi Meyerstein, back in 2006. And many of the different peace-building NGOs based in both Israel and the West Bank had found that they would gain a lot more by collectively working together in Washington to highlight the role, the important role of the bottom-up peace process, so that anything that was decided on the top down could be sustained and built upon. And in the to's and fro's of the Middle East peace process that currently is going through a bit of a challenging moment after the failure of Secretary Kerry's efforts, it was essential that the people-to-people approach of people working with one another tried to look in some successes and really built a peaceful reality from the ground up. So, founded in 2006 with around 8 members, today the Alliance for Middle East Peace has 83 different members spread across Israeli and Palestinian societies that span a whole range of economic, environmental, religious, civic, youth, culture, sport, music, programming, all of which that try to create a reality that will enable the peoples of the region to reach a secure and just peace where everyone can realize the freedoms and dignities and rights that they need in order to live productive lives.
Very good. Joel, I'm not sure if Huda, I know Huda was having issues joining us, so I'm not sure if she's joined us yet. I know she's based in Hebron and works with NGOs there in the Middle East, but I'm asking you maybe to talk a little bit about some of the people-to-people activities you do on the reconciliation front there, what you do to get people to change their perspective about this issue.
Sure, and it's a really important question. And having Huda based on the ground in somewhere like Hebron, which is a real hotspot for how the conflict affects people, is essential for us. Our members, for example, Echo Peace, who are just in Washington, D.C., is a group which is a Jordanian, Israeli, and Palestinian environmental group that work with local communities, for example, on shared environmental issues like access to clean drinking water. So they work, for example, to prevent sewage spill-off going into the Jordan River that makes up the border between Israel and Jordan, a future Palestinian state in Jordan, and therefore all have shared interest in rejuvenating the Jordan Valley. So they work using this commonality and work with municipal officials and local people, try and get them to realize that everyone has a shared benefit if everyone has clean access to good water, that everyone deals with their sewage runoff. And so what we do on the ground is try and find opportunities for these groups to work together and find opportunities to create a sense of community between groups like Echo Peace or Seeds of Peace that work with Israeli and Palestinian youth, or groups like Search for Common Ground, and find the aspirations where they can collaborate together, and in doing so, try and form a full movement for change.
Interesting. Well, I know I want to take it from Hebron back here to the United States, turn a little bit to the political situation here. Obviously, most policymakers in Washington have concerns about the Middle East peace process, especially as it relates to larger concerns there about the other issues we're having with countries in that area. Tell us a little bit about what your organization does on a regular basis to engage with members of Congress from both parties and also with the Obama administration.
One of the main focuses of OMAP, the alliance, and through our support through Square Path and Books, is really to engage on the Hill and with the administration to ensure that resources are provided to support peace and reconciliation programming. 6 years ago, we managed to gain an appropriation that is fed through the Office for Conflict Management and Mitigation in USAID that earmarks specifically $10 million per year that can go in to support this sort of programming. The U.S. government and the people of America through Congress are incredibly generous with the time and attention they pay on the Middle East peace process. But this earmark is the only part of that money that is dedicated to building up this sort of people-to-people ground-up work that we believe is essential for its success. So a lot of the work that all that does is working with members from both parties and ensuring that this money can remain and sort of be protected through the different challenges on the budget. In addition, we work very closely, of course, with USAID and the mission in the region to educate our members about this and sort of provide technical training. We work with the State Department, with the White House, with Department of Defense and the Diplomatic Corps, trying to convey what our members are seeing and feeling on the ground to give the U.S. administration a direct line into what's going on the street, on the ground. And then with Congress, in addition to sort of the work on the CMM grant money, we have some pending legislation working with a bipartisan bill to try and introduce an international fund for Middle East peace, which is one of our objectives on the upcoming Congress.
Very good. The you mentioned the international fund, which sounds fairly interesting. Why don't you walk us through some more details about that?
Sure. So in 1986, President Reagan passed with bipartisan support the establishment of an international fund for Northern Ireland that between 1986 and 2010 distributed over $1 billion to Catholics and Protestants and economic development assistance and sort of people-to-people work trying to sustain any peace in Northern Ireland. And the fund was tremendously successful. We look to adopt that model and create a global entity focused on scaling and funding people-to-people activities between Israelis and Palestinians. The aspiration would be that the International Fund could provide an independent source for easily scalable programs to expand their reach. Our members probably reach over 20,000 people a year, but with increased resources, they could reach hundreds of thousands more. So the aspiration is that the U.S. would be able to would create this fund, which they would fund 25% of at the tune of $50 million a year, and that the European Union, other international states, including members of the Arab League, and the private and public sector would come together and create a $200 million fund for the Middle East peace process, for people-to-people and reconciliation programs to apply to. They could scale up this work. It really demonstrates, and if you think about the amount of money that, for example, it goes into to pay for Secretary of State Kerry's airplane to fly backwards and forwards just to the Middle East on his essential diplomatic work, this money is basically the equivalent of what would be spent on just fueling the plane. And so we need to ensure that we're investing in the legacy outside of the negotiation room, and that's the sort of fund that we're pushing in at the end of this Congress and the next Congress in a bipartisan fashion.
Gotcha. Well, tell us, are there signature accomplishments the last couple of years that you want to brag about, or maybe conversely, a couple of challenges that you all are looking to bring fresh approaches to?
Sure. You know, our bragging points in terms of in D.C. are very much seen in context of the very challenging aspect of the region. OMERP has been tremendously successful in its growth of now up to 83 members. We've secured over $60 million in USAID CMM funding year upon year since the appropriation was founded. We've reached out and met with over 112 members of Congress who have signed their colleague letters supporting the appropriation, and we hope to have a piece of bipartisan legislation on the international fund put in to the House before the end of this congressional session. That, however, should be seen against the real difficulties that our members are seeing on the ground. And as the trust between Israelis and Palestinians and between Arabs and Jews more generally reaches to a real low nadir at this point, the aspiration would be that we can find ways to limit the fragility of the people-to-people movement there by helping them resource up. And by resources, we mean not just public sector money being given through the U.S. government or other governments, but also ensuring that more attention is focused on their work in the media and ensuring that in the region that they have an opportunity to work together so that successes in one societal sector, like the environment, can be reflected in other societal sectors as well. Because as I'm not sure if you know, Kevin, the asymmetric nature of this conflict with a powerful party and a weak party means that the challenges that the Palestinian population faces are very different from the challenges the Israeli population faces. And therefore, there needs to be a complexity, a nuance, and an expertise given to support these sort of groups. And it's that level of real expert thinking and really nuanced policymaking that we look to sort of support and push and resource up successfully.
Gotcha. Well, with the closing moments here for our segment, why don't you tell us a little bit more about if you want information on the organization, where to go to find it, and how to be involved?
Sure. So we urge all of your listeners to join, to go onto our website, which is www.allmep.org. Sign up for our mailing list and also find us on Facebook, the Alliance for Middle East Peace, and on Twitter, allmep_USA. And you can follow up our updates there. And if you're interested in this cause and understanding the challenges and tribulations that often the peace movement does have in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, then this is an opportunity to really help those who have come together in this alliance really achieve their objectives in a sustainable way.
Great. Well, thanks so much. We're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way!
Welcome to Washington Gridlock. Patton Boggs' legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for over 50 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and over 50 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has over 50 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than five decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everyone. Well, we are focusing a lot of our attention on this show on international issues, and we've got an interesting one for you. From time to time, we like to bring you analysis of some fascinating legal cases, and we've got one today that comes to us from Miami-Dade County, Florida, and it's a cross-border sovereign litigation case that reads a little bit like a movie, and talking about embezzlement of hundreds of millions of dollars from one of the largest banks in Ecuador. The case is called Republic of Ecuador versus Isaias. And joining us are two colleagues of mine, Alvin Dark, a partner in the Squire Patton Boggs Miami office, and Digna French, also a partner in that same Miami office. So, Alvin and Digna, welcome to the show. I know you all are both very accomplished litigators, and that this is a complex story that involves a variety of legal elements. Digna, I want to start with you and ask you to tell us what led up to the lawsuit and what happened at the trial itself.
Sure, Kevin. Thank you. Basically, what occurred was that in the mid-1990s, Filambanco was the largest bank in Ecuador, and Roberto Isaias was its president, and William Isaias was the vice president. In 1998, Filambanco's books and records and the reports that Filambanco was submitting to the government regulators made it appear as if the bank was solvent, but it was going through some liquidity problems. As such, Filambanco began to request loans from the Central Bank of Ecuador, which were granted. We're talking millions of dollars in loans. In essence, the truth is that the Isaias brothers were actually hiding the fact that the bank was insolvent. And eventually, in December of 98, the bank had to be placed into a restructuring plan under the jurisdiction of the Republic of Ecuador. And at that point, the government realized that Filambanco was actually insolvent, despite what the bank records declared. The CBE, the Central Bank of Ecuador, continued to inject money into the bank in an effort to salvage it, but it was unable to do so. And in July of 2001, Filambanco closed. Thereafter, what the government did was that it employed international accounting firms to do an investigation of the financial condition of the bank as of December of 98 when it was turned over to the government, and issued a report that basically evidenced that the loss to the depositors was in about $650 million. What occurred was the government ensued with a criminal investigation. Arrest warrants were issued against Roberto and William Isaias, and at that point, they fled the country, and they ended up here in Miami. The government, pursuant to its laws, it seized a number of entities that belonged to the Isaias in an effort to recover, some of the loss. And they did, however, much is still owed to the Republic. And what we did was that then we filed a lawsuit down here based on the amount that was still owed, having taken into account the amount that was recovered pursuant to the seizures. That lawsuit was filed. Well, we've been litigating the case for approximately 5 years now. And throughout the litigation at the trial court level, the parties agreed, and in fact, the court orders at the trial court level were all consistent that the active state doctrine applied in this case. The active state doctrine is a doctrine of international law that, in essence, prohibits courts down here from looking behind the actions of sovereign nations taken within their own borders, affecting their own citizens, and basically employing their own laws. And there were two important orders that were issued by the trial court. One of them was a motion to dismiss that we had filed against the third parties that were trying to intervene in our lawsuit, claiming that the properties that were seized were their properties and not the Isaias's properties. And we filed the motion to dismiss pursuant to the active state doctrine, which was granted in its entirety. The second order was a motion for summary judgment that we filed against the brothers who had filed a counterclaim against the Republic. And again, that motion was also granted based on the active state doctrine. What occurred was that the brothers then came up with a new claim. What they said was, well, the active state doctrine does not apply because there's an exception that actually applies. And they employed the second Hickenlooper exception, it's called. It's the extraterritorial exception to the active state doctrine. And what they said was, pursuant to that exception, because the Republic was allegedly attempting to seize property here in the United States, then the active state doctrine does not apply. The trial court agreed with that argument and granted summary judgment on behalf of the brothers. We proceeded to appeal that decision, and that's we appealed it to the Third District Court of Appeal, and I guess that's the decision we're going to talk about here now in more detail.
Yeah, well, that's a great summary of how we got to where we are today. So, Alvin, having gone through the trial process with Digna, now tell us a little bit about the appeal issues and what outcomes were achieved there.
Sure, and it's Alvin Davis, not Alvin Dark.
Alvin, I apologize. I'm looking at the wrong line. I apologize.
He played second base for the New York Giants in the 50s. Well, the appeal went up on this issue of the court having collapsed both our effort to get a money judgment and the possibility that getting a judgment, we would then go after their property into one conclusion that we were going after their property. Essentially, what we did at the Court of Appeals was we pulled those two apart as they properly should have been addressed separately. And the Court of Appeals, following the outlines in our appellate briefs, did just that. They went back to our complaint, which said we wanted a money judgment, that we weren't trying to seize property. They said the fact that we might seize property to enforce the judgment did not collapse the two together, and that therefore we were entitled to proceed in the trial court to obtain our money judgment. The appeal was so clearly articulated in the briefs that the court did not even require oral argument. They just ruled on the briefs, and it was a unanimous decision. The brothers, who are indefatigable in their efforts to protract this dispute and to avoid payment, then moved for a rehearing by the original panel, a rehearing en banc by the entire panel of seven judges, and failing that, certification by the appellate court to the Supreme Court to have the Supreme Court deal with this as a matter of unusual interest. And the Court of Appeals promptly denied all three of those motions. So the case is now back before the trial court. We will be going before the trial court shortly to have a new schedule established and put the case back on the trial docket.
So now, Alvin, I know this story has been featured in the New York Times, Daily Business Review, and Law 360, and that this is kind of another feather in your substantial career cap here. You're kind of a go-to litigation guy for the Republic of Ecuador. I know you represent a lot of other major corporate interests in big-ticket litigation there in Florida, entities like Florida Power and Light. So tell me a little bit, though, about how this case in particular is going to impact the client going forward.
Well, I think the principal thing is that this is a matter of extreme attention, if not importance, in Ecuador. The brothers are still very influential there, and every opportunity they have, they plead their case about being persecuted politically and by about being driven from the country. And the press down there picks it up, as you would expect. That's the story. It's not the dog biting the man, but the man biting the dog. And so one of the principal benefits of this has been for the Republic to be able to publicize this result to demonstrate that they are continuing to pursue these people in the courts and that they expect to get the relief that that they believe they're entitled to, because a lot of this money was depositors' money. It wasn't simply money from the government. So this has been very helpful to the government of Ecuador in terms of dealing with this issue on the domestic political front. In terms of going forward, it clarifies the law in Florida, which had not been addressed, frankly, before. As you would expect, there are not a lot of these cases. But now it is clear what may be pursued, what may not be pursued, and that the courts are available to other countries, other entities who have been defrauded by people who then happily settle here with the proceeds of their fraud.
Gotcha. And real quickly, I got about 2 minutes left, Alvin. Tell me how this decision is going to impact other sovereigns and what kind of counseling you would give to non-U.S. companies who are going to find themselves perhaps in similar cross-border embezzlement issues like this.
Well, it provides a roadmap for those other sovereigns to know how to go about, particularly how to plead the case so that you don't run into the confusion that the court here encountered. So it will... First, it lets them know that relief is available. Secondly, it shows them how to properly plead for that relief so that they don't get bogged down forever in the court efforts. Of interest here was that the brothers only had a limited number of claims that they were trying to pursue back against the government. And when they were thwarted in that, they lined up 16 more of their companies to intervene in the case and try for the same effort to thwart the government. And we were successful in having that intervention effort defeated.
And real quickly, Alvin, the precedent on this active state doctrine that Digna talked about, what does that mean at the state level and at the federal level?
Well, it reinforces what the federal cases have held. We relied essentially on federal cases because, as I said, there was not state law on this. So it reinforces the law on the federal level in a way that is helpful to sovereigns. And in Florida, it essentially creates the law so that now people will know how to proceed here.
Very good. That's going to wrap it up. For people who want to learn more about Alvin Davis and Digna French, their litigation practice, I encourage you to visit us at the Squire Patton Boggs website, search their names, and pop up their bio and make contact with them. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a minute to talk about the Trans-Pacific Trade Talks here on Capital Thinking.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way!
Welcome to Washington Gridlock. Patton Boggs' legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for over 50 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and over 50 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has over 50 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than 5 decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Welcome back. I must be having a bad day, or I failed geography, because I mentioned in the cutout to the last segment the Trans-Pacific talks. We're actually instead going to be talking about the Trans-Atlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. This is one of the reasons that I am not a trade representative in any part of the world. But joining us to talk about the Trans-Atlantic Trade and Investment Partnership is Karen Kadelko, one of the star associates here at Squire Patton Boggs in the policy shop, who focuses a lot of her attention on foreign policy, international trade, and agriculture issues. So, Karen, welcome back to the show. And beyond people like me are confused about which ocean of trade we're talking about, give us just a little bit of background on what they call TTIP.
Sure. Thanks, Kevin. So, as you mentioned, TTIP stands for the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is basically a series of trade talks between the U.S. and the European Union, or the EU. Both of these huge economies are looking for ways to get rid of barriers to trade in both goods and services, so barriers like tariffs and complicated differences in regulatory systems. President Obama formally announced TTIP in his 2013 State of the Union address, but it had been in the works for a few years. Since the formal launch, though, there's been 7 rounds of negotiations, some here in the D.C. area and some in Brussels. But I really think the important thing about TTIP is that the trade relationship between the U.S. and the EU is the biggest in the world. Some $2.2 billion of goods and services are traded between them each day. The two economies make up half of global GDP, a third of world trade flows. I mean, that adds up to almost $1 trillion annually. And that's just dollars, though. So looking at jobs, for example, EU companies in the U.S. support over 3 million jobs.
Interesting. 3 million jobs is quite a bit. So when I think of trade with Europe, you know, I don't think of us as being involved in knockdown, drag out fights with the Swiss or even the French. You know, I think of those as sort of the warmest relationships the United States might have. So why exactly do we have sort of arm's length trade negotiations in those instances?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the relationship between the U.S. and the EU is clearly doing very well, in part because, you know, there are a few tariffs and duties involved, and they really see eye to eye on a lot of issues that are causing controversy in trade with other parts of the world. So, I mean, you're right. In this way, the U.S. and the EU are much farther along, but there's still some market access progress to be made and actually a lot of room for improvement in what are called beyond the border issues.
Ah, okay. Well, let's get into that. What do you mean by beyond the border?
Sure. So that's a sort of catch-all term for any kind of efficiencies or duplications that can add costs to trade. So it includes, for example, when the U.S. inspects a product like a piece of chicken or a car, and then that product gets sent over to the EU where it faces another set of essentially the same inspections because their standards are so similar. You know, this sort of duplication adds costs for importers and exporters. They have to pay for processing, paperwork, administrative fees on both sides, and that applies to services as well as goods. So the idea for beyond the border measures in TTIP is if the U.S. and the EU take time, talk it through, they could probably find a way to either recognize each other's regulatory processes or agree on a single new process. So this is all called regulatory streamlining. And with the size of the trade relationship as huge as I outlined, this regulatory streamlining can really significantly cut costs for importers and exporters. And I have to say that's actually especially true for smaller businesses who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford to cut through all that red tape.
All right, so what else do they have on tap in this conversation about TTIP?
Well, it really does aim to be comprehensive. So I mentioned market access. They're looking at opening markets in agricultural goods like livestock and dairy. In addition, the EU is looking to get more imports of U.S. natural gas and oil, and that's been really controversial. And then in the regulatory space, they're both looking at financial services, intellectual property, pharmaceuticals, investment disputes, and then, you know, they're hoping to tackle all of that while keeping issues in mind like sustainable development, environment, and labor.
Ah, okay. So seven rounds. I mean, that sounds more like a title prize fight than it does trade negotiations. Is that standard? And you know, are things progressing nicely here?
Well, you know, the two sides, they actually hope to wrap up negotiations initially by the end of this year. But given all this work, it's actually become clear it's going to take a lot longer than that. There's been a lot of concerns raised on both sides already. So the EU, for example, is now examining thousands of public comments on whether investment should even be addressed in the agreement at all. The EU is also really worried about the security of U.S. data privacy after the NSA scandal. And then, of course, this is all setting aside the fact that the EU is actually made up of a ton of individual countries, each with their own views on trade. And then, you know, on the U.S. side, you have people saying the EU approach to GMOs and food safety isn't based in science. And then the U.S. is under pressure not to include an energy chapter in TTIP, at least the way the EU has proposed it. And then I guess also in the agriculture space, the U.S. farm groups and members of Congress representing key farming districts and states have been really worried about this EU proposal on what are called geographic indicators or GIs. If they made it into TTIP, these GIs would restrict the use of a name of a product to the place where that term originated. So, you know, Parmesan cheese could only be labeled that way if it came from Italy. You can quickly see, I guess, why this would be an issue of concern to U.S. producers.
Yeah, I need access to my Parmesan cheese. So, you know, is the public paying much attention here, and does that matter?
Yeah, it definitely does. So, you know, in addition to weighing in on each individual issue, the public has also criticized both sides for a lack of transparency, which has really become a big issue. The public has had a chance to weigh in during what are called stakeholder engagement events at these negotiating rounds. You know, there they can discuss their thoughts and concerns with the negotiators. But the text being negotiated itself is technically not supposed to be made public. So the negotiators say, well, you know, they're worried that any released draft text could be scandalized before it even becomes final, and then that could basically tank the agreement. But sometimes, like actually we've recently seen with the energy chapter, the text gets leaked anyway. But in the face of all this criticism on transparency, the EU only a few weeks ago published the negotiating mandate. And that's the sort of directive the EU has been operating under since the start of the talks. I mean, the truth is that a lot of people think that these talks are happening behind closed doors, which is putting a lot of political pressure on both sides.
I see. Well, so speaking of political pressure, we're 12 days away from an election that may change control of the Senate. How does that impact the conclusion of these negotiations?
Yeah, so it's already had an impact. The EU officials are being finalized, but they won't take their spots until November 1st. And then, of course, we in the U.S., as you mentioned, have our elections after that. And all of this election activity has kind of led to a pause on both sides of the Atlantic on any real TTIP momentum. And, you know, then, of course, after elections, both sides are going to need time to take stock on, you know, what to do in this new political landscape, how to staff up, things like that. And then as a whole separate issue in the U.S., the elections have had another impact, which is they've slowed progress in Congress on legislation called Trade Promotion Authority, or TPA.
Ah, yes. So talk to me a little bit about TPA.
So TPA would essentially give the administration the authority to eventually move agreements like TTIP through Congress using an up or down vote without amendments. So, and as you can imagine, in today's Congress, that would be very useful in getting legislation passed. But in turn, TPA also is actually how Congress sets out its international trade objectives that the administration has to follow. But it's actually now looking like TPA won't get addressed until next Congress, since we don't think it'll be taken up in the lame duck session.
All right. Well, give me, I got about 90 seconds left. Give me the final forecast for TPA.
Sure. So, well, you don't have an official date, but the next round of talks could be in early December. That's expected to come after a November meeting between the U.S. Trade Representative and the new EU Trade Commissioner Delegate, Cecilia Malmström. But I think, you know, the bottom line for the outlook is that the negotiations have really only just begun. They've been stalled by totally far apart offers on market access, on regulatory issues. In the last round, at the very beginning of October, they did make some progress. The EU tabled some papers in regulatory, you know, for chemicals and autos, and a couple of formal proposals. But the U.S. is going to table its own proposals, and then these are all just starting points. So it's really still in the very early stages. There's a few, I would say, optimistic officials that are saying that TTIP could be wrapped up next year, but I actually think we'll likely see the talks trickle into at least 2016.
Very good. Well, for folks who want more information, you can find Karen Kadelko and her contact info on the Squire Patton Boggs website. We're going to be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs. A bipartisan voice with knowledge and over 50 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We're going to turn our attention to some intellectual property issues. Joining us is one of our regular guests here on Capital Thinking, Deborah Lodge, who's a partner at the Squire Patton Boggs Washington, D.C. office, where she focuses her practice on intellectual property, privacy, and internet law. So, Deborah, I know we're going to talk today about one of the things going on called Operation Full Disclosure. So tell me a little bit about that. That's from the Federal Trade Commission, I believe.
Exactly, Kevin, and I'm so delighted to be back today. Thank you for asking me. And yes, in addition to IP issues, I also handle a lot of advertising, and that, you know, goes hand in hand because it's really part of the whole issue of, you know, what are you telling the consumer about your product and what you do? And recently, the FTC launched what it calls Operation Full Disclosure relating to advertising disclaimers. And it did that by sending letters to many national advertisers, some really large ones, some smaller ones, reminding them about the duty to make disclosures and disclaimers truthful, obvious, and clearly informative to consumers. And it was really interesting because the FTC didn't bring a case yet anyway, but they sent these letters reminding the advertisers that they should really review their advertising.
Gotcha. So how did they determine which advertisers got these warning letters about the failure to make adequate disclosures?
That's a great question, and it's interesting because the FTC has not even disclosed the identity of the recipients of these letters. We do know that they went to at least 20 of the 100 largest U.S. advertisers, and they went to advertisers of many different kinds of products and services. But it's interesting because, you know, one thing that this whole operation tells us is that the FTC is reviewing everyone's advertising. And it's easy to do that because many things are online. And of course, the FTC regularly reviews television advertising and you know, radio broadcasts and things like that. Not including us. I'm sure that this is very clearly disclosed in terms of Capital Thinking, but, you know, you never know what they're looking at.
Yeah, so what does it mean to have a clear and conspicuous disclosure? Does it differ for if you're doing print or television?
The concepts don't differ, but the execution will. And the FTC is doing all this under its mandate under Section 5 of the FTC Act, which prohibits unfair or deceptive acts or practices. False advertising has traditionally fallen under that category as unfair or deceptive. And what the FTC is saying is the disclosures have to be clear, they have to be meaningful, they have to be near the claims that they relate to, and they should be easy to read and clearly accessible to consumers. The FTC's description of the advertising that led to these letters gives us many clues about what the FTC is really looking at. And those clues have been reinforced in some cases they brought recently, including one that you're probably interested in, Kevin, because I know you've got school-age kids. It was against an educational service called WordSmart, where, among other things, the FTC found that the claims that, these programs would increase kids' IQ and increase SAT scores by 200 points were deceptive and misleading, and that the disclosures intended to, qualify those claims did not cut the mustard.
Gotcha. Yes, I am concerned about that as a father of school-age kids. Let me ask you, what does all this FTC action mean in the world of online and mobile advertising?
It means a lot. And actually, the FTC referred in its press release about Operation Disclosure to the FTC's.com guide. And that was a publication back, I think, in 2013, where the FTC went through really what it means to make disclosures clearly and conspicuously in online and mobile environments. And there were a couple of, really very clear guidelines that the FTC issued that really are very instructive to anyone who is operating and advertising in an online environment. Among the things that advertisers should remember is that the FTC really thinks that the disclosure should be near to the claim, and that if space is a problem, they should try to put the disclaimer or disclosure into the ad copy itself. It's not favored putting disclosures into a LinkedIn page, but the FTC realizes that sometimes that's necessary, and when it is, they remind the advertiser to, make the links obvious, make the links labeled, that consumers should really look at this, put the link near the info, and make the link direct so that consumers don't have to click through, 6 or 7 pages in order to get to the meat of the issue.
Very good. So with all this going on, Deborah, we've got about 3 minutes left. What would you give as sort of some do's and don'ts if you're counseling clients in this space?
I would say really that they should look at their advertising with a view to, what does the consumer see? What is the consumer likely to take from this? Is it clear? The FTC made a big point that, you can't, quote, correct misleading statements that are made in an ad by putting something in a disclosure that says, no, I didn't mean that. That really is not okay in the FTC's view. The other thing I would, remind consumers and advertisers about is that, that the ad claims need to be substantiated well thought out and clearly made. The FTC is very active. They're going back to basics. And I think that it behooves advertisers to take a quick review of their advertising and figure out, does it measure up to these standards?
Very good. Any other final thoughts on what people should be doing or where you think the FTC might be going next in these instances?
The FTC is clearly utilizing these letter kinds of campaigns to signal to advertisers where the FTC has problems. Just the other day, they sent some to plastic bag marketers regarding oxo-degradable claims, saying that, well, they might degrade, you know, if these bags are exposed to air, but not in landfills. And that reminds advertisers that the claims that they make have to be meaningful to consumers as well.
Very good. All right. Well, we've been joined by Deborah Lodge. If you want more information, visit us at the Squire Patton Boggs website. Look Deborah up there, and she'll be happy to chat with you. That's going to do it for this week's Capital Thinking. Have a great weekend. We'll be back with more next week.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.